When the book How Democracies Die was first published in January of 2018, the United States had just marked its first year under Donald Trump's presidency. U.S. politics and its politicians had crossed a number of unprecedented lines, dangerously damaging the boundaries that have sustained American democracy for nearly 250 years, according to authors and Harvard professors Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt. The two had long studied the demise of foreign democratic governments and could no longer ignore the signs of impending crisis they were seeing at home. Their look at the fall of liberal democracies around the world and a roadmap for rescuing our own was hailed for its sound argument and cogent analysis of the threats facing American democracy. The book is now available in paperback. It is entitled How Democracies Die, and it is a pleasure to welcome Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt to the roundtable this morning. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Very nice to have you both here. Stephen, give us a sense of how this project originally came to be.
Well, Daniel and I work on very different regions of the world. Daniel works on Europe, and particularly during the 1930s. I focused mostly on Latin America, and what happened was that during the 2016 campaign, early on in the primary season, we started to see behavior and hear language that, although we'd never heard it before in American politics, really struck us as pretty familiar from these other regions of the world. And we felt like we'd kind of seen this movie before. We'd seen politicians behaving in ways that were potential threats to democracy. And that got us concerned and about the fate of U.S. democracy. We started doing a little bit of reading, writing, and talking. That's what led to the book.
Daniel, when you look at that, is it inevitable that that would catch up to the United States?
Well, you know, the U.S. is a very old and rich democracy, depending how one counts. I mean, in some senses, the U.S. is really a fully democratic country since the 1960s only, but it's been a very stable constitutional system for, of course, over 200 years. And in general, old, rich democracies don't die. And so there's a lot of reasons to think that the U.S. was immune to many of the trends that have affected other countries around the world, other countries that we have studied in our other work. But that's really what made it so striking, is that around the world today, we see in rich old democracies, including Western Europe, the rise of new populist parties who really challenge the basic democratic rules of the game. So in some sense, the fact that it finally has come to the U.S. is not surprising, but I still think at the end of the day, the U.S. has a lot going for it. It's old constitutional system, it's a robust civil society, and so the game is certainly not over in the U.S., but there's new challenges that really look familiar from other parts of the world.
The book is now out in paperback. It came out a year ago in hardcover. Have you seen any profound differences in just the year?
Sure. The biggest difference obviously came with, or the biggest change came with the Democrats' victory in the midterm elections. So whereas the initial concern was that there would be insufficient opposition to possible authoritarian encroachments, now we've got a situation of divided government, which really changes the game a lot. It doesn't necessarily mean that we're in the clear, as we're seeing as we speak. The challenges are different. The challenges are that we may face really pretty devastating gridlock and conflict between the executive and the House of Representatives, and that rather than a sort of a Trump on the offensive, we may see Trump on the defensive, who could be sort of dangerous in different ways.
And Daniel, when you think of those dangers, and so far that American democracy has survived the first 2 years of the Trump presidency, what are the concerns? Because there has been further weakening over the last year as well.
Yeah. So as Steve noted, really, that there's been a change in the first 2 years versus now. I mean, I think in the first 2 years, what you saw a lot of was similar strategies that were seen in other countries where somebody who comes to power who's not really committed to democratic norms. And one of the first things that, looking at Hungary or Turkey in the last few years, what these leaders do is they often try to capture the referees of the states, or the neutral arbiters, law enforcement, judicial institutions, intelligence institutions. And we saw some signs of that under Donald Trump, I think, with the firing of James Comey and other efforts to kind of squelch investigations. There was some sign of that taking place in the U.S. A second kind of thing that one sees in other countries is an effort to tilt the playing field, to change the electoral rules, for instance, in a way that favor the incumbent, to make it hard for the incumbent to be dislodged. There was some initial movement in that direction with the formation of an electoral commission under Kris Kobach that was intended to kind of stamp out election fraud, but really was an effort to change voting rules to benefit Republicans. That was eventually disbanded. So in many ways, the fact that we got this election result that we got in this past November shows that our electoral institutions continue to be vibrant. And similar efforts to tilt the playing field in Hungary, for instance, and to rewrite electoral rules helped the incumbent and passed. And so in that sense, we look very different. But these were really serious efforts to kind of tilt the playing field, as well as efforts to go after the media and the free press. This is also something that one sees in other countries, and one has seen a lot of that over the last 2 years. A lot of it has been rhetorical, but words matter, and public opinion has really begun to shift, especially among Republicans, attitudes towards the press. And there's really a feeling among Republicans, according to surveys that I've seen, that Republicans really just don't trust the press. And it's hard to really sustain a democracy when you don't have huge sections of the population accepting the press. So in this sense, there has been real threats. Again, as Steve has said, the threats now are changed, although we really think the underlying causes of the crisis before and today remain the same.
You write in the book about polarization and that deepening polarization is a great danger that we face. Given that politics is so polarized, you point out that politicians grow tempted to use any means necessary to defeat their rivals, and then the voters are more likely to reward rather than punish that behavior. Stephen, are we on the front end of that or the back end of it, do you think?
I'm not sure that I can say. I don't think we know. I can tell you that it has continued, this trend, which began a couple of decades ago, which we write about a lot in the book. There's no, unfortunately, no sign that I see that it's crested, that the tide has begun to turn. The polarization persists, and we're seeing the consequences of it daily. We're seeing it in the utter inability of the two parties to make the kind of really basic negotiations and compromises necessary to make our government work. It's gotten to the point where for many, many politicians, really in both parties, sitting down, crossing the aisle, which used to be a staple of American democracy, is seen as something akin to treason.
Daniel, when you think about where we are right now and the response from the people in the midterms and some of the movements that have taken place, It is certainly moving, but it also then becomes a bit more entrenched, and people do become, in other words, it seems that as you try to dig yourself out of the polarization, there's the risk of becoming even more polarized.
Yeah, and so, you know, it's really, I think, good news, no matter what aisle, side of the aisle one is on, Republican or Democrat, it's good news to have constraints. So in other words, the Democrats winning the House of Representatives is a good thing. That's how our system of checks and balances is supposed to work in a presidential system where you have divided government. And, you know, in the past, divided government, as Steve has noted, has led to significant legislation nonetheless. I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean gridlock. But in a context of high polarization, checks and balances can easily degenerate into institutional warfare where each branch of government views the other side as really being an existential enemy. And one looks around the world, and we report on this a bit in the book, in Latin American democracies, historically, there's often been this kind of institutional warfare between the different branches of government. And what one sees right now, I think, in the U.S., and we're just at the beginning stages of this. You would ask, are we at the back end or the front end? I mean, certainly in terms of this dynamic of institutional warfare between the branches of government, we're just at the beginning end of this right now, the beginning of this. There's really parties that are opposed to each other and who view a victory of the other side in a kind of zero-sum fashion means a loss for me. And so there's really little room for cooperation. And so what we really call for in our book is for kind of reformation of the Republican Party, first of all. And second of all, we insist that Democrats not imitate the kind of norm-breaking behavior that they criticize in Republicans. It's really tempting to just imitate the kind of rule-breaking behavior and norm-breaking behavior of really pushing to the max. But we really think the Democrats ought not behave that way. And in general, the Democratic Party leadership has acted with incredible self-restraint and been disciplined and fought hard, as we see in the government shutdown. But on the other hand, tried to abide by basic democratic norms. And that's really critical for rebuilding democracy.
In the book, you have developed this litmus test that helps identify autocrats ultimately before they come to power. Give us a sense, Stephen, of those warning signs that make up the test and how it works.
Oh, this is just, and again, I should say from the beginning that there's no perfect litmus test. There's no
right.
perfect means of identifying autocrats before they come to power. But nevertheless, if as is the case today, most democracies die at the hands of elected leaders. No longer is it the case that military seize power. Usually it's elected presidents and prime ministers who subvert democracy. If that's the case, it's really important to look at our candidates, to look at our politicians, and identify the ones who are more likely to threaten our institutions before they come to power. And so we developed, based on the work of a great Spanish political scientist, Juan Linz, what we call kind of a set of indicators of behavior that should set off warning signs. They're no guarantee of anything, but they should set off warning signs. So one of them is a willingness to question or violate basic democratic rules. Another one is the encouragement of or condoning political violence. Another is a willingness to curtail the civil liberties of opponents, including in the media. And the final one is a denial of the basic legitimacy of one's opponent. And we applied this test to Trump and found that he tested positive, that he was someone that we should have worried about.
Once then elected, that only becomes worse, right? I mean, because they become emboldened, I would think, no matter who we're talking about.
Yeah, well, you know, we really feel like, you know, we applied this test to Trump and his rhetoric before the election. And so it's really, you know, this is a kind of way of identifying him ahead of time. And then once in office, what we found is that he's as authoritarian as advertised. You know, he's gone after political opponents. He's decried political opponents in this kind of language which doesn't treat them as legitimate opposition. He's criticized the media. He has showed real kind of indifference, if not hostility, to the basic rules and functioning of America's democratic system and the rule of law. And so in many ways, we've seen all of this come, you know, we've seen evidence that the litmus test actually has been quite predictive. What's certainly important to note is that he's been also very constrained. I mean, our system of checks and balances, despite flaws that we talk about, has worked quite well and works better than in many other political systems. And so as a result of that, despite really clear authoritarian instincts, he's been constrained by our institutions.
Then why doesn't it feel better?
Well, it's not, you know, it's. I guess the point, when I say he's been constrained by our institutions, I don't want to have that taken out of context. I mean, there's more sign of trouble than
yeah.
any political system, any moment in you know, the 21st century American history. You know, if you compare this to Richard Nixon, where there was kind of a sign ultimately of Republicans coming and separating themselves from Nixon and come, you know, in this famous story of Goldwater and several other Republicans coming to Nixon and saying, unless you resign, we're going to have to impeach you. You know, we haven't had that moment yet. And so maybe that moment will come, but since it hasn't yet, it feels like we're in a very dangerous spot.
Dangerous and highly dysfunctional. Like, even in the best case scenario in which Trump proves fairly inept and fairly weak and is not able to consolidate power like somebody like Erdogan in Turkey or Orban in Hungary, even if that does not happen, and I think it probably will not happen, we're witnessing every day first of all, someone who's unfit for the office of the presidency and a political system that has grown utterly dysfunctional. So there's a lot to worry about, even if authoritarianism is not around the corner.
So let me ask you about a word that you write about in the book, and I'm just interested in it because we hear so much about it, and that is norms. The norms of politics, the norms of presidency, of government. And it is certainly safe to say that the current president assaults many of those basic norms. You talk about in the book that it is not unusual for any president to go against norms. So what is it that we're seeing now that is different?
Well, I mean, first of all, norms change all the time. Their societal standards, societal norms change all the time. So it's, as we say in the book, it's not at all unusual for presidents who might represent a generational change, for example, will behave in different ways and violate norms. And most norm violations are really somewhere between completely benign and not very problematic. But we're not talking about all norms. We're talking about two very specific and crucial norms for the functioning of any democratic system. One of them is forbearance, which is a restraint in deploying one's institutional power. And we're seeing that's very much an issue today with the government shutdown and Trump's threat to circumvent Congress and build the wall anyway. And this idea of mutual toleration, which is accepting your rival, not as your enemy, but as a legitimate rival. So our focus is specifically on those two key norms. And the problem with Trump is not so much that he violates a whole bunch of norms, and one may find that personally distasteful. The problem with Trump, or a problem with Trump, is that he is completely dismissive or almost incapable of adhering to norms of forbearance, of engaging in restraint in deploying political power. And you cannot make a democracy work if politicians are unwilling to engage in self-restraint. And that self-restraint is not Trump's forte, to say the least.
So let me ask, I think, a somewhat obvious question, which is, by endorsing and or just not saying anything, the Republicans are breaking those norms as well, right? I mean, if you just stand by and watch, you are complicit in that.
Yeah, I think it's certainly, and this is a dynamic that one sees throughout history. You know, there's a sense in which I think maybe many Republican members of Congress feel they're in this really difficult spot where they don't particularly like the president, but they don't want to criticize him because they're tied with him politically and same party and so on. But it turns out, and one of the points in our book is that throughout history, this is often how democracies get into trouble, is that you have mainstream establishment politicians. So whether one's talking about Weimar Germany, Italy in the 1920s, Venezuela in the 1990s, you have mainstream politicians who seem very reasonable and have good intentions. There's an outsider who emerges who's connected with them politically, ideologically, in terms of party. And rather than drawing a line, they say, well, they kind of waffle and say, we can figure out how to cooperate with this guy. You know, he's maybe bad, but the opposition's even worse, so we better cooperate with him. And one sees this happening over and over. And in every instance when this happens, democracy gets into trouble. And so in that sense, it's really irresponsible, although one can also sort of understand, you know, the very human dynamic of people acting in their self-interest. But at the end of the day, for democracy to survive, politicians as well as citizens need to act courageously. You know, whether this is a violation of a norm, I guess the point is that if you see somebody violating democratic norms, you have to draw a line in the sand and say you won't cooperate with these people. And if one doesn't do that, then one is really putting democracy at risk.
Steve, if I could go a little further,
yes,
than Daniel,
please.
I think the Republicans are guilty of more than just standing silently aside. As we've seen in Wisconsin, in North Carolina, in Michigan, in other states, Republicans across the country have increasingly been abandoning restraint and engaging in what we call constitutional hardball, really using the letter of the law in ways that violate its spirit. So unfortunately, it's a problem that extends beyond Trump and that likely will persist after him.
When you think about the norms and you think of how things have have changed, how concerned should we be that, I mean, there's a million ways of saying this, putting the toothpaste back in the tube, of a return to a different set of norms that is more palatable to democracy?
I mean, I think we have to get there. We're going to have to address this underlying problem of polarization, which is imaginable. I mean, one can imagine a scenario. It's hard to say when it will happen, but one can imagine a scenario in which a essentially white nationalist appeal, an appeal only to small town and rural white Christians, is not enough to win elections for the Republican Party. And where the Republican Party concludes, Republican Party leaders conclude that they cannot remain viable unless they appeal to younger, urban, and in particular, non-white voters. Once the Republican Party makes that shift, once it adapts, once it becomes a more diverse political party, one that is more appropriate for 21st century United States, it's plausible to think that polarization will be reduced. Once polarization is reduced, once the two parties look at each other and don't see each other as aliens or enemies or existential threats, then we could think about rebuilding basic norms of cooperation and restraint. I don't think it's that far-fetched.
The name of the book is How Democracies Die. It is now out in paperback from Broadway by Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us and sharing with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is How Democracies Die by Harvard professors Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt. It is published by Broadway. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.